Welcome to the Out of the Woods podcast. The top five headlines threat hunters need to be thinking of this week.
Hey everyone, welcome to our weekly edition of the Out of the Woods Threat Hunting Podcast. This is Scott Poley here with Tom Castura.
Hello everybody.
And this weekly segment features the top stories that threat hunters need to be thinking about, as well as our thoughts on the subject and our hunting strategies. So with that, let's dive into the top threat hunting headlines for the week of October 7th, 2024.
All right, I think I'm kicking us off today, right, Scott?
Yeah, what do you got?
So the first thing I have today is a blog post from AquaSec. It's titled PerfCTL, a stealthy malware targeting millions of Linux servers. So the malware is highly stealthy and has been active over the past 3 to 4 years, targeting Linux servers by exploiting more than 20,000 known misconfigurations. Big flashy numbers there. It focuses on servers that are internet-facing, making a wide range of organizations potential targets. Pretty efficient at defensive evasion. An initial entry sees a seemingly common file dropped in /temp, like httpd, which echoes to an Apache service, which will copy itself to memory, then delete itself, leaving behind another suspicious file in /temp in a hidden directory called sh, which most people familiar with Linux would be familiar with that. And this allows it to masquerade as common Linux processes. It will establish itself further, trying to leverage various rootkits and continue to copy itself in multiple locations for persistence, like under /root.config/cron or user bin perfcc. It also drops additional tweaked binaries in the home.local/bin, like crontab, which is used to schedule and manage recurrent tasks, LSOF, which lists open files and shows processes that are using them, LDD, which is used to display shared libraries required by an executable, and TOP, which is used for real-time monitoring of system performance, which help hide the malicious activities in the event someone is actually using those binaries. The main goal of the malware seems to be cryptojacking the CPU resources. This was identified in the research by the communications out to various crypto mining pools. And then that binary that's dropped, that SH, that is dropped within the /temp, it also communicates outbound to various Tor IPs. So, you know, overall, I thought this one was pretty interesting, Scott. Been seemingly over the past few weeks, we've seen more Linux-based malware kind of pop up. You know, the way the malware worked kind of hard to hide itself in relative plain sight, as well as building upon itself to kind of leverage the system resources while allowing the user to leverage common processes as if nothing was happening. And I thought this was a pretty cool one. You know, what did you think when you read it?
Yeah, I always think it's interesting to see how people are leveraging Linux, because you either have like attacks that are just the most basic, right? People, you can tell an attacker just knows a few things about Linux and assumes that no one is actually monitoring Linux the same way they monitor other types of operating systems in their environment, which in a lot of cases is true. I do feel like there is less visibility of Linux, but Linux isn't as big of an attack space. Like, usually people attack applications that are running on Linux, not Linux itself, but they use some of the underpinnings of the OS to help with their attacks. But it kind of took me back to when, you know, just doing some of like red team, blue team exercises, like at CyberShield, where we actually, you know, we had Linux in the environment and there were parts of the attack where it was very obvious that the adversary or the red teamer had good knowledge of the Linux environment. And they used to do like really crafty things, to kind of hide what they're doing or to kind of prevent us from, seeing their activities. And one of the ways, you know, they kind of counter some of our, you know, I guess defensive strategies on those were they would see what we were doing to investigate because they had access to the system and could see what we're doing. And then they would change their attack to counter those things. So example, we used to the command you can run to see who's currently logged into the system, like active users. Well, that command, you'd run it and it'd pop out the users. They edited that not so much binary, but script that runs for that so that it wouldn't ever display the compromised account they compromised and were using, right? So similar to here, right? They're replacing all these visibility things with top and LSOF and stuff like that. So that I thought was really interesting, but I also thought that they talk about how stealthy everything is here. But one of the things you always look at from a Linux perspective, especially for either a point of execution or persistence, is cron jobs, right? And it looked like they still leveraged a cron job initially to guarantee the execution of what it is they're trying to do. So if you even had telemetry of that, there may have been enough to start looking at other interesting things. The userland rootkits, it was interesting. I was trying to look through what they were saying the code was doing. And from my understanding, it looked like they basically had a specific like environment string set. And if it's set, that means that the crypto miner is running. And so then it would basically, I don't know if they would kill the miner or it would hide it from the execution or whatever before they'd run the top commands and have it come across of, is it there or not, to kind of hide it and then can restart it. I'm not exactly sure because I'd dig in too far. But either way, if it's just something that's running ahead of what's the actual payload, that's interesting. But even if it is a separate bin altogether that has that exclusion, you're going to see, I didn't see any time stomping associated with this. I don't know if you saw that.
Nope.
But that's something that, you know, modification times, like knowing your base modification times for, you know, OS specific tooling, things in the bin directory, when those times change, you know, granted, obviously updates will change those, but some of those tools still won't get changed, right? So if you just had something simple of just diffing timestamps from a simple command, I mean, you can almost use, SOAR or other types of applications to achieve that, or even have something run local on the machine that does those checks and then will send an alert based on, you know, if there's discrepancies and stuff like that. So there's some like defensive strategies I think you can even take for some of these things. But it is, and it's always interesting to see like the amount of effort and steps that an attacker would go through. And they're playing, you know, to basically Linux strengths. I mean, Linux, the way the operating system's set up is everything is a file, even the process IDs and everything is tracked as a file. So they kind of manipulate moving files, deleting files, pulling things into other files. So there's just a lot of activity. Granted, a lot of the activity isn't typically monitored, but yeah, no, it's a very interesting read. If you're not familiar with certain components of Linux in general, I think it's a great article just to kind of get your feet wet of like, what is it that, you know, actors could consider when they're live on a Linux system? And this kind of showcases a lot of those different techniques and behaviors that if you can actually wrap your head around and have some strategies to defeat or identify, you'll be in a way better place just with that knowledge alone and some approaches to those. So yeah, it's a good find.
Yeah, I think even from a perspective of just considering what you might want to enhance for visibility, right? So, you know, most at least from what we've experienced, a lot of times, you know, there's not a lot of in-depth logging occurring for most organizations on their Linux systems, right? It's pretty basic syslog stuff, maybe some audit D, rarely anything like Sysmon for Linux or anything like that that can give you more visibility, right? So, yeah. What do you got for us, Scott?
I'm going to jump into something a little less technical, just to kind of break it up a little bit. And, you know, I sometimes always like to look at the psychology of things when it comes to cyber attacks, because there always are motives outside of financial. And in this case, this is kind of it. But basically, there's an article from Security Affairs, and it gives hackers launched an unprecedented cyber attack on Russian state media, VGTRK, on Putin's birthday. They don't really give the specific technical details. They just basically say that they claim the attack. It did hit online broadcast, internal services and communications, and basically did some wiping, disruption, and destruction as far as that goes. And, you know, it's interesting from the perspective of psychology, because obviously they're doing it because if they can create a show of force that's visible to especially the citizens of Russia, it might show maybe like, hey, maybe we're not as strong, or maybe our government doesn't have as big of a grip on everything. You know, that visibility can kind of hinder support and things like that from the Russian standpoint. So there is that kind of psychology warfare there going on. But that's why it's also important to understand your adversaries, I think, because, you know, I think if you know that your adversaries come from maybe a Muslim state, then you know there are certain holidays that are really important to them where they maybe would want to perform an attack for like a show of force to kind of like, hey, rally up and like, look what we did. Or there might be certain days where maybe they wouldn't do an attack because, you know, culturally, ethnically, whatever, those are days where like we don't work, right? I'm not saying that everyone honors that kind of like that guidelines or those guidelines, but you know, it's always, if you understand your threats, understand their motivations, understand almost their background or drivers, it does kind of help you. And I hate, you know, you and I've been in this business long enough when people are like, oh, we should be on high alert, right? Well, I mean, we should always be on alert. It shouldn't really necessarily be a higher alert. But if you know certain times of years, because you're usually dealing with multiple threats, right? So then you might be paying more attention to maybe behaviors and techniques of those adversaries around these times of year or these significant dates or whatever versus other adversaries. So, you know, we've talked, and this is kind of a more of a strategy thing too. You talk about hunting, and sometimes you're like, I've got all these hunts I want to run. Which ones do I start with? This might help dictate that, right? I know there's other processes and other requests that kind of dictate what you hunt sometimes, but if you kind of are aware of enough of your adversaries and threats, you might be able to say, hey, you know, this is this time of year, this is significant, we have this adversary that's on the list, let's focus on their TTPs, and, you know, during this time more so when it comes to a resource management perspective. So yeah, it's just like I said, it's an interesting piece. It's not surprising, but I like to kind of keep this type of train of thought in people's minds because it isn't all just technical work sometimes. So yeah, what was your take?
So the first few things were not to play to it being okay, but I laughed. It was kind of a funny one of those, like, it almost bordered on the line of like a funny hack, even though I know it's serious. I'm not trying to take away from that. Mm-hmm. And then the second thought I had was, you know, my first thought with something like this is it's a distraction, you know? So like what else is happening?
Weird. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then, you know, to your points, you know, a couple things that I think you were spot on there when you were talking about like looking at this as a study of how and why someone might, you know, use different timeframes to attack. You know, I remember when we did a few kind of in-depth dives and environments that we sat in. I think there's plenty of reports that back this too. I don't have any off the top of my head, but yeah, the time thing, especially around when you're thinking about how do I prioritize assets in my environment to do a targeted threat hunt or put more focus on a specific thing, whether it be I want to monitor this area, I want to be on, you know, that damn buzzword, on high alert for other things. You know, there's other things to consider too, even if you don't know what the adversary necessarily is, but you know what their intent is, right? Soft example like that is, you know, a lot of phishing campaigns tend to happen around key financial times of year where people are, you know, are high, right, high action, doing a lot of things, you know, like in the US around tax times, you know, the beginning of the year. Exactly. They're expecting emails that they don't get all year long. They're not entirely sure what they might be, right? The holidays, same thing. You're getting a lot of advertisements, a lot of stuff. People are quick clicking, doing all their shopping. We've statistically seen the massive uptick in attempts and attacks and campaigns in those time frames. So yeah, it's something else to think about. But yeah, this was pretty cool. This was a nice little change of pace, Scott.
Yeah. All right. Well, what do you got for us next?
So staying in a relative bit of that flow. So the next thing I have is a article from Proofpoint, security brief. Royal Mail lures deliver open source Prince ransomware. So, you know, Proofpoint recently highlighted a campaign impersonating British postal carrier Royal Mail to distribute Prince ransomware. The threat actors use phishing emails as well as leverage public contact forms to send malicious PDF attachments, which then led to zip files hosting JavaScript embedded in LMK files. It is worth noting that these zip files were hosted on Dropbox. Once triggered, the scripts executed PowerShell commands to deploy the ransomware. In the PowerShell commands, we see, you know, Base64 encoded commands that execute both AMSI bypass as well as the Windows Connection Manager UAC bypass. A lot of these techniques, you know, things we've seen. This, I don't think anything as far as the techniques or the technical side is necessarily net new for ransomware or the methodologies behind it. But interestingly, this ransomware is openly available on GitHub, and it lacks decryption mechanisms. And the primary cause, it primarily causes data destruction, seemingly with no intention of file recovery, even if the victims pay the ransom. You know, even more is a nice little call out mention that if you would like to include Windows Defender bypass in the code, all you have to do is contact the creator via Telegram. So, you know, I thought this was more light, not heavy on the technical side, although I think a lot of the things there are things that we've echoed in the past, you've echoed, we've seen. They're pretty common behaviors for attacks like this. But I think the majority of the techniques being relatively known, the behaviors for sure, this kind of makes that, you know, another call to that notice of how easily someone, really anyone, can get their hands on a tool set like this and potentially cause a lot of impact, you know, to any given target. That's the part I think out of everything is the most scary to this. I don't know. What did you think when you read this one, Scott?
Well, I mean, just to pick up on your last comment, I know, you know, with just a few lines of PowerShell code, you can just use Windows natural encryption code and library to basically do ransomware, right? So like, people don't realize it's not some like sophisticated tool to encrypt a bunch of things. The sophistication is getting the access to the environment to do it at mass scale and also do it in a way where none of the activities to get to that point get picked up. But encrypting files is, I mean, you don't even know. It's almost like a point and click, know the right command to type, you know, that kind of thing, right? From, you know, the simplest perspective. But this was interesting because, like, we talked about the Linux attack, a lot of activity was to kind of be quiet. This is just like, in my opinion, looking at activity, just loud, right? Now, granted, it's some of this is a machine speed. So unless you have actual things to interrupt the processes here, you might see impact. But the good news is it looks like it's very single target oriented. So it's like the impact overall, personally, it might suck, or, you know, you might have someone who loses a little bit of data, but it's not going to be a huge business impact. But, you know, thinking about the chain of things, so from the user perspective, right, they get a PDF that then has a link in it that then takes them to Dropbox, where they have to download a zip file. It's password protected, so they have to put in the password, and then they have to run an LNK, right? Like, the amount of effort just to get the user to go that far, there should be so many red flags in your training that you should say, if you have to do this many steps to get at something from a source you don't know, you already failed in your awareness training, right? Like, you're not doing a good job having those conversations with your people, because I think this should be you do more than three steps or two steps, and it's someone you don't know, just, you know, raise attention, alert, you know, whatever. So there's the human aspect. Now, the other thing that's interesting is now you've got LNK. So now I'm thinking like process execution here. You've got an LNK that's executing FindString, which is also an executable. It's basically locating an embedded JavaScript and dropping it in the user's temp environment variable. So, you know, you'll have Explorer running FindString. FindString isn't really run that often, to be honest. Like, I don't know how often it typically would be run. But I have seen where that's just kind of come up in attacks because it's a utility that's lay of the land that achieves things like this. But either way, the LNK is going to execute WScript, right? Well, WScript is basically going to drop four files. It's going to drop three PowerShell files and one JavaScript file. And so now you're going to have JavaScript drop files and then run PowerShell. So you have WScript running PowerShell, which, usually is a bad sign in a lot of attack scenarios as well. So there's enough behavior there. And then what's interesting is like the PowerShell scripts. The one thing I have to give them credit for is the names are like PS1, PS2, PS3. They're not single character names. So, you know, kudos to that part at least, right? Couldn't call that out this week. But yeah, so, you know, there's just a chain of activities. And like I said, that's kind of machine speed. So, you know, you'd have to have something to interrupt that to not get the impact. But the behaviors there are your typical malicious behaviors, right? So those things, I think, relatively easy to pick up on, and also great training points where no one really should fall for this if they're taking cyber awareness training. If they are, then you need to reevaluate how you deliver your message. So, yeah, kind of my take.
Yeah, not to be the negative Nancy on that, but we know users will use her, right? Like it'll happen for all kinds of various reasons. But yeah, you know, I'm thinking, Scott, just as a little note here, I'm working on a nickname for you for this podcast specifically. I'm kind of thinking like Scott, single character executable poly, but I got to build on that a little bit. I just want you to know it's in flight.
So I'm going to have like this underground tag name. That's cool.
What do you got next for us, Scott?
All right. So this next one is from Talos. And so it's Talos Intelligence. And it's called Threat Actor Believed to be Spreading New Medusa Locker Variant Since 2022. So basically, they've been tracking this threat actor since 2022 that's associated with Medusa Locker. And they have this new variant that they've kind of seen being distributed that they are calling a Baby Locker KZ. I didn't really get to why. I might have missed why they were naming it that. It might be something to do with the PDB path based on the names in there that they extracted all that. But what is interesting is some of the behaviors that this adversary uses. And I've talked about this before, but the directory they like to drop all their tools and files in, as far as like the initial breach, pulling things over, doing whatever, is in the user's music folder, which is always like, I've talked about this before from the perspective of there are specific folders that are kind of defined in Windows, like pictures, music, videos or movies or whatever they are. And it's almost like you could create a list of detections for non-standard extensions showing up in those folders where you wouldn't expect them. And for really two reasons. One, obviously it would work for this adversary because they're trying to hide in a place that probably no one ever looks, to be completely honest. Even the users typically don't use that space. I feel like, especially if you're on a work system. But two, insider threat scenarios. I've seen and read reports where that's where, hey, all of a sudden there's like 40 gigs of data in the music folder at work, and that's where they're actually harvesting data, or in the videos folder, that's where they're harvesting data to kind of hide it until they're able to extract it or take it off the system or remove it. So just looking for non-standard things in those locations, simple detections to really build if you want to alert on it. If there's a chance you might get overwhelmed with alerting when files get created there, sure, you can hunt for it as well, but there's an opportunity there. So that's something to pay attention to. The other is, you know, a lot of times when you see, you know, lay of the land is a big topic, right? Everyone breaks in and they want to use the binaries that already exist to do a lot of the work. Well, that also requires some knowledge of those binaries. Like, you have to have an idea of how to use them effectively and also use them to achieve the success you're looking for. So in other cases, a lot of adversaries, if they're not going to develop their own tool stack, they use off-the-shelf stuff as well. And this actor clearly uses a lot of off-the-shelf stuff. You know, the list, and this is important because I think if there's off-the-shelf stuff being used, these are things you need to use in your test environment or whatever, just to see what telemetry is associated around them. Like, for instance, advanced port scanner, that was one I actually, it's in the report, they used it. And I actually ran with that personally one time for another instance, because a lot of ransomware authors, just the younger ones, use that a lot. And I realized that that scanner itself has a portable mode, right? Where you can like launch it as a portable executable, or you can actually do an install. And obviously I was thinking, well, gosh, if I was attacking a system, I would do portable. So I wonder if that would reduce the amount of telemetry. No, it doesn't. If you actually look for just the name Advanced Port Scanner Registry, it created so many registry entries, even though it's in portable mode, just because of how the product's designed, right? And the adversary is not going to be able to hide those tracks. And I don't know if the adversary is going to even pay attention to those. But us as defenders, when we discover tools like this that are freely available, just running them and not even like using them to the max capability, but just if you launch them or install them or whatever it takes, just see what happens first. As just an indication. And then you can kind of play with, okay, well, if I do these things now, is there anything that new? You learn a lot, and it also really helps you build out your defenses, especially against ransomware type groups where they're going to use off the shelf stuff all day long. But some other things to look at that I have not personally, you know, they have HR Sword. I guess how you say it. Basically, it's a tool to disable AV and EDR. NetScan, very similar to Advanced Port Scanner. I haven't looked at specifically the telemetry there. They did use Process Hacker and PC Hunter 64, which is similar to Process Hacker. It's a way to just basically learn what processes are running, so you can kind of enumerate more what's going on in the system. They use Mimikatz, kind of standard for a lot of things. But they also use a checker tool, which is kind of a I don't know if it's a tool they created, but it bundles other apps inside of it. Apps associated with credentials to kind of help manage those. But the apps that it bundles inside of it is Remote Desktop Plus, PS Exec, and Mimikatz, all of which have ways to be detected or things to look for, right? So, you know, the big thing here was, you know, it's interesting to see there's these types of attacks going on. Oh, and that was the other thing I wanted to mention. So Mimikatz, I don't know if it's because they're using a free app to wrap around it, if they're using an app, the checker tool, to wrap around it, to include it with all their credential management for their attack stuff or whatever. But I think this is the reason why Mimikatz, you can run an interactive session on, right? So that you kind of open it up and then you can kind of interact, put things in, run commands, and those commands aren't captured on the command line. It seems like a majority of the commands they're running for Mimikatz was run as single commands, because if you look at the command lines they captured in the report, it clearly shows where they run the full command they want to use Mimikatz for, passing whatever they need to pass, and then they exit. They run the full command and exit, which is good if you don't have an interactive session. You'll see Mimikatz run this way, right? But also, it shows that there's probably something else running it, getting the results and returning it to whatever their checker tool is. But just knowing that, it's a great way to identify, because the structure of what Mimikatz commands look like with certain keywords, with double colons separating things, very easy to identify. And then they also use rclone. I forgot to bring that one up as well, which is, you know, commonly used to extract data, some common arguments there. And what's interesting too, it doesn't look like they really changed a lot of the tool names. Not saying you should go off the tool name for identifying, but you know, that in itself is kind of a lazy perspective. Maybe they don't do it because a lot of tools now will track original names, so you know, people usually key off those instead. But yeah, those are some really key things that make this one really easy to not get too worried about, because you can put a lot of things in place, and they spell out some key things that if you were to look for those, I guarantee you'd find this adversary for a while, because it probably they've used these techniques since 2022. So what do you think?
So I had a few thoughts on this. You know, the first thing I was, you know, kind of shocked by a little bit. I don't know if you were, I don't know if this rings pretty true in your head, but when they were talking about the numbers for the telemetry that they seen, where, you know, they basically looked at how many victims per month they were seeing. So they find the specific stat. I think it was something like 200 or 100 victims per month from October of 2022 into Q1 of 2024. They steadily seen compromise of 200 unique IPs per month. Like that was pretty loud to me. You know, the 100 victims per month thing, I think, stood out a little bit. I'm not necessarily surprised, but it was a little shocking to read. But, you know, kind of circling back to, you know, into the hunt piece, a few thoughts I had to kind of build off yours is to the, this made me think back to like, you know, some of the original days of diving and data, things like this, like when I think of scan, like these port scanners or network scanners, there's legitimate use for them, but by and large, in any given environment, very few people are actually going to be using tools like this.
And the frequency won't be high too.
And the frequency won't be high, right? So, you know, it's things, you know, when I see reports like this, it just makes me think back to where, you know, maybe I'm in my infancy of really kind of digging into my environment. Maybe I'm just getting started learning how to threat hunt. These are good entry points to the threat hunt where you can go and look for common scanners in your environment, wherever your data set may lie or whichever tool set you have to dig into the data that you have in your environment. Just looking for these kinds of tools to see if they're anywhere in your environment. And, you know, not to oversimplify it, but keyword search stuff for scanner and process hacker and things like that. I think a lot of people would be surprised what it might yield in your environment. At a minimum, it lets you get to know your environment more, right? Or understand that you just can't see these types of things. And maybe you need to put some priority on, you know, your telemetry, what you can see, what your visibility is. You know, there's always, and we tend to talk into some of the depth of the threat hunting, because we've done it for a little while. And, you know, I guess I just wanted to take this opportunity with this because I thought it was good points to, you know, there are simpler methods that you can just start at to find some pretty good data to really get you looking at things that are happening in your environment. Simple ways.
Yeah. So I think, you know, you bring up a good point. Anytime you see these types of reports, sometimes the best thing to do, especially if you don't know exactly what actions you're going to take, or there isn't that sense of urgency, like you have, like you come across this on your own, it's not like, hey, handle this. It's always a good idea just to take a step back and just casually look at the data, like you said, and explore before you like try to solve that. Because if you understand what the data is already before you try to solve those problems, you'll have a much higher success too.
Yeah, or maybe you're in a newer SOC, or maybe you're in a newer security situation, and you know, you just want to know how many people in my environment use these network scanners. Like typically, well, let me see that. Then I know, and then you know, in general, depending on what the data returns, you could pretty quickly build a detection off that, and you know, exclude the people that you know are known to use it, and you can give yourself a pretty high weighted thing to go look at for your analyst, right? As just one example, like there's a lot that can be done with details like this.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think that sums everything up. I just want to make a couple call outs. There is the Information Security Summit happening here in Cleveland, Ohio. It'll be around the 22nd to the 24th. But we'll be doing some live podcast interviews. So you'll have more information or more material to check out towards the end of the month. So just kind of put that on your radar. And hey, if you happen to be in the area or plan on attending, make sure to stop by and say, hey, we'll be around. Also, don't miss out on our live edition of the podcast, which is going to be October 24th from 7 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The Blood, Sweat, and Threats, Carving the Perfect Threat Hunter is the theme of that kickoff season 2. So with that, I really want to thank everyone for joining this current week of Out of the Woods Threat Hunting Podcast. Look forward to syncing back up next week. And with that, that closes out our top threat hunting headlines for the week of October 7th, 2024. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everyone.
Thanks for listening to the Out of the Woods Podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you heard this podcast so you never miss an episode. For more information or to connect with Cyborg Security, check us out online at www.cyborgsecurity.com and follow us on social media. We'll see you next time.